Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hello, Smart Money Tree Podcast listeners. Welcome to this week's show. My name is Kirk Chisholm, and I will be your host. So today we're talking with Bill Zox. How are you doing today, Bill?
I'm doing well.
Good. We brought Bill on because there's a lot going on in the markets, and Bill is a portfolio manager at Brandywine Global, and wanted to bring him on to talk a lot about high-yield bonds. So, Bill, tell us a little bit about your background.
Sure. I was a tax lawyer for 7 years coming out of school, and then I've been in investment management for 21-plus years. I am a portfolio manager with John McClain on the Brandywine Global High Yield Fund and the Brandywine Global Corporate Credit Fund. And the third member of our team in Columbus, Ohio is Jack Parker. Most of our colleagues are in Philadelphia. The Brandywine Global also has offices in London, Singapore, and Montreal.
So how did you get into high yield bonds? To me, that seems like I didn't come out of college saying, hey, let me get into bonds. Those are really sexy, right? So how did you get into bonds?
Well, I mean, most people don't get out of law school and say they want to become tax lawyers either. So I was always attracted to, sort of niche areas that people were very passionate about, but didn't necessarily attract the most people or the most attention. At my prior firm, we were just getting off the ground as an asset manager. And two of my colleagues at the time were at the tail end of their career, and they were starting up a credit strategy. And they needed some help. And my legal background helped me somewhat because I knew something about the bankruptcy process and I knew something about how to read bond documents. So it was sort of a logical move for me to focus on corporate bonds at that time.
Let's talk about the legal background, how that comes into play here. So why does that come into play? You talked about bankruptcy. How does that come into play with bond portfolios?
The way we manage high yield, we're not distressed managers, so we're trying to avoid defaults and stay out of bankruptcy. Occasionally, we find ourselves involved in restructurings, but that's not really our game. But it does help to understand how that process works. That's the ultimate margin of safety that you have as a bondholder, how you would fare in a restructuring or bankruptcy. So to have some understanding of how that process plays out is helpful to understanding the valuation of the bonds.
I think that brings in the question of margin of safety, as you alluded to. So, I mean, high yield bonds are obviously riskier than treasuries. So how do you account for risk when you're pricing a bond?
High yield bonds have more credit risk than treasuries, which have essentially no credit risk. But there are other risks associated with bonds, such as interest rate risk. And a large portion of the treasury market has more interest rate risk, for example, than high yield bonds. But that margin of safety, the most important factor in that is the value of the equity. The equity is below the bonds in the capital structure. In theory, that equity has to be worthless or near worthless before the bonds are permanently impaired. So we look at high yield bonds much like a value equity manager would look at a stock. You know, what's that business worth if someone were to pay cash for the entire business? And then, you know, where are we in the capital structure compared to the equity or other debt claims on that business?
I know back when I was in college, an internship at General Re, and we had a lot of conversations about the historical default rate of bonds. And I think before 2000, there was a pretty, I guess the standard was pretty well known. But since then, I feel like there are a lot fewer bankruptcies and defaults than there were before. So what changed to cause that to happen where there's just people aren't defaulting as much?
The high yield bond market in particular has matured quite a bit. When you got out of college, those were the very early days of the high yield bond market, and the quality of the issuers has improved dramatically. The quality of the businesses and the quality of the bond structures has improved over that period of time. And then also the Fed has played a very significant role in the market since the global financial crisis in particular, providing tremendous support, especially during the 2020 beginning of the pandemic, the Federal Reserve, in partnership with the Treasury, provided enormous support to the corporate bond market overall, and to some extent to the high yield market as well. So defaults have been, you know, relatively low, let's say, over the last 20 years, other than the global financial crisis and a little bit of a blip during 2015, 2016, when energy was extremely weak, and then a little bit of a blip during COVID. But for much of that time, defaults have been very low.
Before I get into the Fed's role here, let's talk about 2015, 2016, because that to me was very interesting. It almost was the start of a contagion effect, which started with the energy markets and could have gotten worse, but didn't. I forget the name, but there was a fund that basically three funds that were frozen three separate days in a row. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because that to me, I find fascinating.
Sure. I mean, energy is the largest single industry weighting in the high yield market over the last 10 years or so. And so it was probably 14 to 15% in 2015. It's maybe 13% now. And then other commodities are another 3, 4% of the high yield market. So that was really a case of, you know, energy peaking in the middle of 2014 and then suffering a very dramatic decline that ultimately priced the entire high yield market for recession. We got to about 900 basis points spread in high yield. That's additional yield over Treasury's credit spread. On February 11th of 2016, that's where we were the Monday after Lehman Brothers filed bankruptcy in 2008. You're really priced for a pretty significant recession when you get to 900 basis points spread. That was a case of high yield being a canary in the coal mine because the primary issue was energy, and energy was such a large part of the high yield market.
You mentioned credit spreads. Talk about that a little bit, because that's really important when it comes to high yield bonds.
That additional yield that you get over Treasuries is designed to compensate you for default losses. So that would be what percentage of the market defaults, and then what is your loss upon default. But it also compensates you for other things like illiquidity or volatility, which will vary at times. So if you look at the investment grade portion of the corporate bond market, default losses are very close to zero, but you're still getting additional spread over government bonds to compensate you for less liquidity and volatility than you would find in the government bond market. So that excess spread is a very important part of high yield as well.
Realistically, when would be the best time to invest in high yield? Because, well, I guess before I get to that, what's the current spread now approximately?
The spread right now is about 330 basis points.
Okay.
As I mentioned, it was 900 basis points in February of 2016 when you were priced for a fairly severe recession.
Is 330, is that normal, or is that, because I know right now I've got the Ukraine situation going on. What in your mind is a good spread to look for when you're finding high yield bonds?
You have to start with what are the current conditions in the market. And despite all of the talk that we hear every day about, you know, when will we see the next recession, high yield defaults are currently near zero. The long run average is maybe in the 3.5 to 4% range, but we're less than 0.5% of high yield defaults is the current run rate. So, you know, one question is how wide can spreads be when defaults are near zero? And we're also not seeing any signs in the high yield market that defaults will pick up materially. There's lots of things going on in all financial assets right now. They really have much more to do with interest rate volatility than credit risk or an imminent default cycle. So those spreads, 330 basis points of spread when defaults are less than 0.5%, is not unreasonable.
1.5% default rates now is really low. I mean, we just had COVID 2 years ago. So what were the defaults then? Is it still that low?
No, I mean, I think we got up to about 6% defaults in COVID. That was a very rapid cycle because of all the government support. And yet, just to be clear, those defaults right now are less than 0.5%, very close to zero. Normally, in recessionary environments, you would think that you would have defaults in 10 to 12% range with fears that they could go much higher. But we did not get nearly that high in 2015. And we also did not enter into recession in that environment. And in 2020, the Federal Reserve came in partnership with Treasury in such a big way. And the fiscal stimulus resulted in a market that recovered very rapidly.
So you attribute a lot of this to the Federal Reserve and their policies? Because to me, it sounds like default is a normal course of the economic cycle. But of course, the Fed doesn't allow that to happen anymore. So do you attribute mostly to them? And the follow-up to that is, if so, how do you manage around Fed policy?
The Fed and Treasury and the administration, Congress, had a huge impact, clearly, in all of these cycles, but especially in 2020. The policymakers did more in a month than they did in a year and a half during the global financial crisis. And what we have seen since then is an enormous amount of refinancing in 2020 and 2021, so that the high yield market is roughly 1.5 trillion US high yield corporate bonds. And you saw over $900 billion of refinancing in 2020 and 2021. So the maturities have been extended. The coupons are extremely low. And the balance sheets are really in very good shape. And policymakers definitely had a lot to do with that. Now, we're at a very different point today with inflation being an issue. This is something different than we have seen really in my adult lifetime. Now, with the Fed very clearly behind the curve on inflation, the Fed cannot step in like it did. And I don't think there's that much political will for Congress to step in and provide more fiscal support. The number one issue that policymakers are dealing with today is inflation. And they really have an interest in tighter financial conditions to bring demand down to contain inflation. We're at a very different point today.
So we have inflation that's kicked in, well, in the last year anyway. You would think that interest rates are going to be pushing higher because of that. And who knows? Only the Fed knows. But with higher inflation, with higher interest rates, how does that affect the high yield bond market? Because just like you said, they refinance their debt at really low interest rates, record low, I would imagine. And interest rates are going to go higher. So I'd imagine a lot of people probably can't afford higher rates. How do higher rates affect the high yield bond market?
It can be somewhat confusing because high yield has suffered a pretty reasonable drawdown this year, down close to 5%. But the credit spread has actually only widened very modestly. What we're really seeing is the impact of higher interest rates, and in particular, higher interest rate volatility. That certainly has an impact on high yield bonds. It has an impact on all financial assets. And one thing that's interesting is normally when interest rate volatility is as high as it is this year, you see equity volatility even higher than it has been. You're always looking at various markets and wondering or trying to analyze how much of this is a signal that we're getting from the market and how much of this is noise. But one very clear anomaly this year is that equity volatility is not as high as you would expect it to be compared to where interest rate volatility has been. So there's been a lot of fear about high yield bonds. I think that some of that fear has been misplaced. It's not, to me, fear of defaults or a very significant default cycle. The fear that is not misplaced is really around this interest rate volatility. Equities have sort of brushed off that interest rate volatility. High yield bonds have not.
There's a big question outstanding in my mind, which is, let's say it's 3 years from now and interest rates are up at, I don't know, 3-4%, which is hard to imagine given all that's going on in the world. However, with inflation at 7%, it's still really low. What happens if interest rates go a lot higher, or they start to reflect more of the environment that I guess I would expect with inflation rates at 7%? Let's say we get interest rates at 5%. Let's just be kind. What does that do to the high yield bond market or the bond market in general, given that we were close to zero for treasuries and high yield bonds certainly weren't all that high in historical standards? So how does that affect that market and the ability of these companies to pay a much higher rate?
As I said, there was an enormous amount of refinancing done over the last 2 years. So the high yield bond market does not have much to refinance until 2025. It starts to pick up. So for the next 3 years or so, there's very little to refinance in the high yield bond market. You know, in other parts of leveraged finance, it can be different, but in the high yield bond market, there's not much refinancing that needs to get done over the next 3 years. So that's helpful. But if interest rates get to 5%, that will clearly put pressure on all financial assets. But I would say more pressure from where we are today on equities and core US fixed income than high yield, because high yield has sort of been hit disproportionately to this point. And with a yield over 6% in the high yield market right now, compared to 4.3% at the beginning of the year, we do have some cushion built in to high yield to protect against higher rates from here.
A lot of debt has been priced at a premium for a while as rates have gone lower. But now that they're creeping up, I would think they'd be trading at a discount, which could be more interesting for the bond market, right?
For much of the post-global financial crisis period, high-yield bonds were trading above par at a premium. The market itself is at a pretty nice discount right now, maybe somewhere around 96 cents on the dollar. That's not that material of a discount, but you can find lots of very attractive high-yield bonds with dollar prices in the low 90s or high 80s, where you're starting to get that is a meaningful addition to your margin of safety, because you're creating your 100 cents on the dollar claim at 80, somewhere in the 80s or the low 90s. Now you are building an additional margin of safety when you pay that much of a discount.
I've been reading some interesting research reports over the last few years that have suggested that the investment grade bond market has deteriorated significantly. Whereas, I forget the numbers, I don't want to misquote it, but somewhere like half of the corporate investment grade bond market is now BBB, borderline junk. And that BBB rating, the amount of companies with BBB rating have increased each year, meaning that the quality of the companies have declined, but they're not quite junk yet. And a lot of people have been talking about this, I don't want to call it apocalypse, but let's say big problem of a lot of these companies being downgraded to junk, and the junk bond market's a lot smaller than the investment grade market. So what do you see happening if that plays out? Because to me, I figure it's everyone knows about it, which means it's probably not going to be a problem. But I'm just curious in your thoughts on that, because I read a lot about that.
That was the real fear coming into 2019 when the Fed in 2018 was embarking on what they're about to embark on now, where they were raising rates and reducing the size of the balance sheet. And in the fourth quarter of 2018, that started to put pressure on stocks and corporate bonds. There was a very real fear that that BBB portion of the investment grade market would suffer downgrades and then overwhelm the high yield market. And we thought that that was overblown at the time, and actually in our high-yield portfolios were somewhat focused on BBB corporate bonds, investment-grade corporate bonds that were priced as if they were high-yield because of the fear that they would be downgraded. That turned out quite well for us in 2019. But that has been a very long-term trend where corporations are interested in lowering their cost of capital. So to have more debt that's tax deductible, still with low rates because of the overall low rate environment, it made sense for them to migrate down the investment grade quality curve. So you don't need to be a AAA or a AA or even a single A issuer. You can still have very low all-in interest costs as a BBB issuer, more debt, it lowers your overall cost of capital. So you saw a lot of companies issuing debt to buy back stock or pay dividends or do other shareholder-friendly actions. It's actually been the opposite in the high-yield portion of the market that was still scarred from the global financial crisis, where the BB portion of the market in the financial crisis, the BB portion is the highest quality portion of the high-yield market. That was maybe 35% of high yield in the global financial crisis. It's been over 50% in recent years. So you're seeing an upward migration in credit quality and high yield, downward migration on the investment grade side. But the markets, they will adapt. Capital will flow into those markets where there are good pricing anomalies, where there are opportunities. I don't worry too much about investment grade downgrades overwhelming the high yield market. We've seen that in the past, and the markets have adapted relatively quickly to that.
That's good to know. I know when the Fed came out and pretty much said they're buying any paper, you know, high yield bonds, I don't think they actually bought any, did they? I know they said they were going to, but did they actually buy any?
In all of the credit markets, it was a very modest amount of money that the Fed actually invested, but the signaling was hugely important, and they had a lot of capital ready to go if they needed to put it in, but all they needed to do was really signal it. And the real focus was on the investment grade side of things. The secondary focus was on bonds that were downgraded from investment grade to high yield after March 19th, I believe, 2020, when the Fed made that announcement. And then a few weeks later, the Fed did say that they could buy high yield ETFs, which also provided a lot of support to the market. But I think in a $10.5 trillion corporate bond market, the Fed maybe committed something like $15 billion of capital when it was all said and done. Very little capital was actually committed.
Where do you see opportunities now? We're in this interesting period. I know bonds have been through 40-year bull market. And, you know, we're coming to a period where that may be changing. I mean, who knows? The way things are structured now, it's hard to imagine a recession or bad times like there used to be decades ago. But where do you see opportunities in the high-yield bond market right now?
Let me back up, actually, and say it's appropriate to stick to a strategic asset allocation right now. I think that this is a very unique environment in my adult lifetime and in the lifetimes of many other market participants. There's not really a great analog to what we're seeing right now. The starting point today in all financial assets is a lot better than it was 3 months ago. So I think you should stick to your strategic allocation. And I think that high yield bonds should be part of that strategic allocation. And as I said at the outset, this idea that you should be terrified of high yield bonds, but stocks are relatively safe, does not make sense at all. Overall, high yield makes sense with a 6% yield and a duration of about 4. If you compare that to what's going on the investment grade side of things, core US fixed income, you're looking at a yield more like 3% and a duration closer to 7. So that relationship makes much more sense in high yield. And then just the drawdown that we've seen in high yield year to date being similar to what we've seen in the S&P 500, I think the strength in equities provides a lot of support to the high yield market because those equities are junior to bonds in the capital structure. But it also means that there's more of a valuation issue, more valuation risk in equities in the near term than I think is probably perceived by most market participants as compared to high yield.
As we kind of wrap it up here, what are some final thoughts from you that you want to leave our listeners with about either about your fund or in general, just about the high yield bond market?
The quality of the high yield market is so much higher than I think is commonly perceived or higher than it was even 10 years ago. As I said, more than half the market is double Bs. You've seen a lot of new entrants over the last 2 years, and these are much better businesses than you would think of when you hear the term junk bonds. So if you think of businesses like, say, a Roblox, Twilio, Square, Twitter, These are high yield issuers that are much better quality businesses. Many of them will have the pricing power to pass through inflationary increases in their cost structure in the coming years. And yields of 6% compared to inflation today, that's not that exciting, but the market is discounting for inflation over the next 3, 4, 5 years is somewhat elevated, but nowhere near the starting yield that you find in U.S. high yield. So again, it's a very topical question. How close are we to recession? And I think the knee-jerk reaction when you're talking about recession is I don't want to own any high-yield bonds. But the reality is high-yield bonds historically have been a great place to be when you're late in the cycle. They tend to draw down much less than equities, for instance, and then recover much faster. That was the case in the 1990 recession, 2000, 2008. 2020 was very different in that high yield came back very quickly and drew down less, but then equities have had a massive rebound. Equities have actually outperformed high yield bonds by about 75 percentage points since the bottom in 2020. That's the real anomaly. And there are clearly opportunities in equities. I'm not saying that you should not have your strategic allocation to equities, but the idea that equities, after outperforming high yield by 75 percentage points from the bottom in 2020, are safe and high yield is terrifying does not make any sense. I think that, you know, high yield should be part of a strategic asset allocation from this point forward.
Bill, I appreciate you coming on the show. Where can people find more about you?
Brandywineglobal.com is the website. And then on LinkedIn, follow Brandywine Global. My colleagues and I put out quite a bit of content on LinkedIn. My co-portfolio manager, John McClain, also has a lot of content on there. So either Brandywine Global or William Zox on LinkedIn is a good place to find that content.
So we're in the panel portion of the show here. So we have our very own Megan Gorman. Hey, Megan.
Hi, Kirk. How are you doing today?
Doing great. We also have our very own Barb Friedberg. Hey, Barb.
Hey, let's talk bonds.
Well, Barb's super excited. So we're going to start with Barb. What are some of your takeaways?
Nobody talks about bonds anymore. And as the senior investor on the panel, I want to say bonds have been a part of my portfolio for decades. You might say, first of all, let's tell everyone, because a lot of you guys out there don't even know what a bond is. A bond is a loan to a company or a government. And in exchange for that loan, you get coupon payments. And some of you guys invest in bonds in funds, which is just a bunch of bonds, or you might buy individual bonds from your brokerage. So why am I excited about bonds? Well, despite the fact that they've really tanked this year, and that happens with bonds when interest rates go up, your bond values go down, but bonds can typically, over the long term, provide a ballast to those volatile returns of the stock market. Although, you know, again, not so much today. So that's why I'm excited about bonds. And I won't give my whole spiel now. I'll talk about it a little more in a little while.
We'll save some of the good stuff. So Megan, what about you? What are some of your thoughts?
Yeah, first of all, I really like bonds. And I think it doesn't get enough press, partly because bonds aren't sexy. The guys who find bonds sexy are the guys chasing one or two extra basis points of yield. So it's not really great cocktail party conversation. But I think there's sort of like three rules that you should keep in mind with bonds. And this sort of gets to Barb's concept of it's the ballast of the portfolio. And we all use that term a lot, but I like to think of bonds sitting in the heart of the portfolio. And if you're in bonds that have more stability than equities do, of course, not right now, but they also allow us to be in equities. So that's why I like bonds. They smooth the ride. It's sort of the difference between being in a Pinto versus a Mercedes-Benz. You want that Benz feeling of taking the curves. So sort of the three things I would tell investors to keep in mind. is that when you're building out the ballast of the portfolio, this is where a core satellite approach is incredibly useful. So I typically, for my clients in the core position, do municipal bonds. I'm dealing in the high net worth space where taxation is really important. I'm also sitting here in the great state of California, which has a phenomenal municipal bond market. I say that because I'm from the great state of New Jersey, and they do not have a strong bond market due to their pension debt. In the sort of heart of the portfolio, I like to put municipal bonds. And if, you know, with my clients, I typically do it with a bond manager, where bonds are bought specifically for my client's portfolio. And I say that because depending on if you can meet those minimums, sometimes it's good to do a bond manager, and sometimes it's good to do a bond fund as the core part of the portfolio. But then there's the satelliting, and this is where something like high yield comes in, because you want to have a satellite to high yield. You want to have a satellite to bank loans, to TIPS, to potentially emerging markets, local debt, to corporate bonds. You want these satellited around your core holding to give you different sort of aspects of the bond market. And that goes to the second point, which is when you're doing these satellites, you are best served doing them through either mutual funds or ETFs. And I would typically focus on mutual funds because that's the third part about bond investing, which is active management matters here because you want someone watching the shop. You want someone looking and reading through the bond coupons and the prospectuses to truly understand what's going on with the underlying issuer. And I bring this up because as a core portfolio, if you were in municipals, in general, municipals over the past couple of years have done fairly well. They've been slow and steady. But particularly last year, having a satellite approach helped you in the bond market. So to give you context, when you look at the indices, the municipal index last year did 1.5%, and bank loans did 5.2%, and high yield did 5.36%. So if you think about it, this ballast, which was chugging along doing quite well, you picked up more performance if you had these satellites around your municipal portfolio. Now, just the last thing I'll say is this has been a horrible year in the bond market. High yields are down almost 8% so far year to date through the beginning of May. But it doesn't mean you shouldn't have this exposure in your portfolio. So that's me on my bonds sort of bandwagon. But like Barb, I love it. It's the ballast. And I just think you need to have some basic rules.
Let's talk about the pros and cons of bonds. I'm going to play a little bit of a contrarian. I know you both like bonds. From your perspective, you know, let's talk about the pros. What are some of the best parts about bonds?
The best part of the bonds, and I'm going to group bonds into two different buckets. One are bond funds, and the other are buying individual bonds. And if you have $50,000, $100,000 to invest in bonds, you can buy a diversified portfolio of individual bonds. And then you can buy them and you hold them till maturity and you collect the coupon. So it doesn't matter what the value does. If you buy a bond fund, then you're going to see more up and down of the value of the actual bond. And if you have to sell it, you might sell the fund at a loss. But over the long term, even when the values of your bonds are declining, like now as interest rates rise, over the long term, it's going to go back up as coupon payments increase and they buy new bonds, et cetera, et cetera. So pros of bonds is, and again, not this year. This year, just, you know, we're in a bad time. Okay. But in general, bonds don't always move in the same direction as stocks. So sometimes when stocks are falling, bonds will hold steady or even go up, like in the first decade of this century. So that's an advantage. And also, you can get a smoother return. You will, in general, not get as high a return over the long haul as you will in a stock portfolio, but you'll get a reasonable 3-5% return depending on the bonds. So that gives you just a little comfort if your stock portion of your portfolio is going down and bonds are holding up. Now, the negatives of bonds are, kind of the flip side of what I just said. You're not going to get great returns from bonds in most cases because you're paid in return for the amount of risk you take. And bonds are less riskier, so they don't command as high a yield or return. So that's a negative. If you're young and you don't care about the fluctuations and you're just going for return and growth, bonds won't give you a lot of that. The other negatives of bonds are when you're in a rising interest rate environment and interest rates are going up, bond values are going down. So that's a negative. You have to kind of stomach that and wait it out in general. So those are the pros and cons.
One quick pro before I get to the cons here, and I'll ask you both this. This is a little trivia question. What was the best performing asset class in the last 40 years, or the asset specifically?
The last 40 years?
Yep.
I don't know, Kirk. What is it?
30-year zero coupon bonds outperform equities by a large margin. I don't have the stat in front of me.
Wow.
But yes. So if you had bought 1980, 30 years zero coupon bonds, you would have outperformed equities significantly with almost, I wouldn't say zero risk, but extremely low risk.
And I would have been a savvy four-year-old.
Yeah.
What was the annualized return, Kirk?
I'll have to pull this up. I can pull it on the next show. I have this deep in my files, but it wasn't insignificant. It was a very big difference in the returns.
Well,
so I will put that in the show notes.
I told this story on another show. And so for those of you that heard it, bear with me. But when I was in high school and went to dinner at a family friend's house, and he happened to be extremely wealthy and very savvy, and my dad and this other guy were talking about investing. And the guy, he owned a trucking company, said, well, I've just invested in 12% government bonds. I don't know what duration they were at the time. You have to pardon me, being in high school, this is all I remember. And that was in the, you know, late 70s, I guess, early 80s. And imagine this, like Kirk said, interest rates and inflation were so high at that point that you could get a government bond, like Kirk said, for double-digit returns. And had you bought a 30-year bond for 10, 12%, that's like a definitely a secure government-protected return for 30-plus years.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was 1981 it peaked out, and it was right around the 30 years, I think, peaked out around 15%, give or take, depending on the bond. Some of them were as high as 20%. Just like Barb said, you sit on that for 30 years, you're pretty happy. I mean, who wouldn't want to get 15% a year close to guaranteed? You can never say the word, but it's as close to guaranteed as you can get.
Actually, I had some munis coupon bonds where you actually clipped the coupons from that time period that were paying 10 or 12%.
Wow. And that's tax-free. So
yes. Even yes.
Especially in certain states. Like California, that's a great thing to own.
Yeah, well, I didn't live in California then, but regardless, unfortunately, they came due and they're no more.
So Megan, what about you? Pros and cons of bonds from your perspective?
We've hit on a lot of them, but what I would say is the con I see for a lot of investors is that they don't have strategy. Bonds are not a transparent market. They are complex. And if you ever spend any time with any bond traders, I mean, these guys are into the minutiae. So what you really have to be thinking about as you go into bonds is what is the risk? And the biggest risk you're dealing with are things such as default and illiquidity, because you know your bond portfolio is supposed to smooth the ride. So part of the reason I said earlier, it's really important to have a manager managing your bonds, whether it's a mutual fund, whether it's a separately managed account, is you want them to be focused on managing your default risk. And this came up in the interview a bit, because what you're looking for them to do is to understand with the underlying issuer the power they have to be able to repay the bond back. So I bring this up because occasionally you'll hear things like, oh, bonds are going to be sold here, or you should buy these bonds. Such and such custodian is going to offer these bonds at market. And you might see somebody buying like a $5,000 bond for their portfolio. But the truth is the average investor doesn't have the ability to really look at that bond, understand the default risk, and then don't have the ability to understand that there is an illiquidity risk to that. Because typically in the bond market, if a bond is worth under $25,000 and the bond market has challenges, sometimes it's hard to sell that bond. And so that's why you've got to be very cautious about default risk and illiquidity risk. And therefore, to mitigate that overall risk, you need an overarching strategy like I talked about earlier, and you need to be having a bond manager, whether SMA or mutual fund. So those are the risks I see, but that's how I think you work through them.
Illiquidity can be a problem, right? In a bond fund, typically you have more liquidity because whether it's a mutual fund or an ETF, they're typically more liquid that people can trade in and out of. The interesting part about that is like an ETF, bonds themselves are generally illiquid. They have a liquidity. People will buy them, but it's not like a stock where you can just punch a button and you can get somebody to buy it from you. You know, there are fewer buyers and sellers. Most bond owners, they buy and they hold. The whole point is to clip the coupons. So one of the challenges is you have ETFs, which are liquid, owning an illiquid security. That in itself is kind of a contradiction and, you know, is a potential problem for things like high yield bonds. I don't know if that'll happen, but I know there's potential issues there. You know, I think if you're going to own bonds, then you need to understand why you're owning them. Now, one of the biggest issues I have with bonds is we just went through a 40-year bull market in bonds. We've all made assumptions about bonds. Some of those assumptions are bonds are safe. Now, you could argue what the definition of safe is. Yes, if you buy them and hold them to maturity and they pay out that interest rate, yeah, you could say that's safe. But what if the bonds go down 50% because you bought a 1% bond and we go to 15% interest rates? Well, now you're going to have lost a lot of money. Yeah, you might get your 1%, but you can't make that 15. So basically your opportunity cost is one of the issues. So bonds themselves, people have this opinion that they're safe because they've been safe for 40 years. And I think one of the challenges is we're getting into a period where interest rates are rising and they haven't risen significantly for the last, I don't know, 20 years. They've gone up a little bit, but every year the top of where they go is lower and lower. So if we ever went to double digit rates, which I don't know that we will, but let's say hypothetically we would, the system's not really built around that. People are accustomed to low rates. And I think there's going to be a lot of problems if that happens. And the quote unquote safety of bonds is going to be in jeopardy. People should not look at bonds as safe. As Megan and Barb says, if you want to have them as a part of your portfolio, understand why they're there for the ballast. Although this year, obviously, we're not getting that ballast. Bonds and stocks are going down. I mean, 30-year treasuries are down 20% this year. It's kind of crazy. Quote unquote safe bonds are not doing very well. You need to understand that bonds are not necessarily safe and you need to understand why you own them. There's no problems with bonds, right? Treasuries are as close to risk-free as you can get, but you have to understand that they don't always go up in value. If you make a 2% coupon off of the treasury and it loses 10%, you lost 8%. It helped, but getting that coupon, but you still lost money. You can't go in just thinking, oh, the stocks are crazy, I'm going to go into bonds. I also want to address the default risk. High yield bonds are an interesting asset class from my perspective because they're kind of like bonds, but they're also kind of like stocks. They trade similar to stocks in that in good markets, they tend to do better in terms of the price that people are willing to pay. They tend to do better. And in bad times, they tend to do worse, but they're kind of a hybrid of stocks and bonds. If you have a good high yield bond manager, then times like this, you know, after the markets kind of settle out and they find a new balance, high yield bonds can actually be really profitable if you have a good manager because they're able to go in there and find good value. The one thing I really like about bonds is you have the smarter, if you had to put equity and bond analysts into a room, the bond managers are typically the smarter ones. That's kind of an industry way of thinking about it, is the bond market is the smart money. Not to say take anything away from the equity managers, but the bond markets tend to be really good at analyzing companies. So if they're in there and they're able to find good value, which many of them do, then it can be a great asset class. You just have to be aware that they can be riskier than just typical investment grade bonds, because as Megan said, you have that default risk. You know, default risk has been historically low recently. So it's something that you might want to rethink what that normal default risk is. But if you take that into account and you price it accordingly, that can be a great investment. So Barb, one thing you had mentioned before the show is this concept of 60-40. People have used 60-40 as an allocation for decades because bonds have been going up in price because yields have been going down. And they use that as a hybrid approach, not all equities, not all bonds, but as a way to find that balance. Right now, that's in jeopardy because yields are going up. So does 60-40 still work? What are your thoughts?
So glad you asked me that. I personally believe that 60-40 is still okay, but I'm going to give you a caveat about bonds because we keep talking about when interest rates are going up, how bond values decline, and that is accurate. But what we haven't talked about is what is the degree. So if you're holding a longer term or a longer duration, either bond or bond fund, it would tend to have greater movements in response to interest rates versus a shorter term or duration bond or bond fund. So for example, interest rates go up 2%, your long-term bond fund is going to decline more than your short-term bond fund. So in this environment, what I think is a way to kind of counteract that with a rising interest rate environment is think about your bond portfolio. Your bond portfolio still has the possibility of doing what we've talked about, the benefits previously, but think about maybe tilting the bonds that you own more towards medium or short-term bonds, because that way, as the interest rates go up, you'll be adding new bonds at higher yields. And so your existing bonds and or bond fund won't decline as much. And your new bonds coming into the portfolio will be at higher yields. So it's kind of a way to get through this period. And also, when we talk about 60-40, we put in the 40%, not only bonds, but cash. And cash allocation. And when you own cash, first of all, although you may lose purchasing power from rising inflation, you can also buy CDs, which as interest rates go up, you can buy a ladder of one-year CDs. If you do that, you will be increasing the yield on the fixed portion of your portfolio over time during a rising interest rate environment. So in general, 60-40, that's the common historical portfolio, but I'm going to switch it around a little because if you're younger and you've got a long history of work in front of you where you're going to be increasing your net worth, your capital, you can tweak that a little and have greater percentages of stocks, which have a higher likelihood of a high return going forward, and a smaller portion of bonds. For those of you that get older, you might move back into that 60-40 mix.
Yeah, I want to actually just put something out there that we've all touched on to some degree is the short term and the long term. There's a chart, which I'll put in the show notes, which talks about what a 1 percentage point change in interest rates will do to the value of your bonds. The short term, it's very small. But if you're looking at a 30-year, I'll give an example. If you go from 2% to 1% on a 30-year treasury, you will have made 22%. Of course, if it goes up 1%, then you lost 22. However, on the 5-year, you would have gained or lost 4.7%. So the returns are very significant in the valuation based on a change in interest rates. And the longer term tends to be more, quote unquote, risky. I shouldn't say risky. The volatility is greater with the longer term because the change in valuations is more significant. I'll put that in the show notes. There's a great chart which talks about all this. It pulls out all the numbers in a nice graph. Megan, so if we're looking at high yield bonds, which, like I said, I think it's a great asset class if you time it well. Personally, that's my opinion. So how do you look to invest in high yield bonds? Like, what is a good rule of thumb or some rules of thumb that you can give investors that they should use to think about this?
I think I gave them at the beginning. So I think you need a strategy, but you need to be core complement. And I put high yield bonds under that complement approach. I don't time the market. When they've studied it, it's very, very hard to time the market because it requires a number of key decisions. And so therefore, having a core complement approach where your core is in high credit quality bonds, and then you complement it with other aspects of the bond markets, from international bonds to high yield to bank loans to TIPS to mortgage back, then you are able to have a diversified bond portfolio. And bonds, you know, over the long term will help stabilize your portfolio. But as I've said, they're not sexy. You've got to have a strategy, and you've got to make sure you're thinking through how it's going to be managed, from making sure you prevent default risk and liquidity risk.
So as a follow-up to that, one thing I want to ask, because I know you work with a lot of municipal bonds, how do you measure, I don't want to call it default risk, but you know, given a lot of the problems in like government pensions, I just saw a report out this morning which talked about, you know, government pensions are going to be at risk because of the decline of valuations in bonds and equities. And, you know, long term, they're trying to manage that flow of distributions. When you're thinking about municipal bonds, how do you think about it given some of the risks out there?
This is where you have to really think through the management team who is going to be managing your bonds, whether it's a bond fund or a separately managed account, because you want to understand their process. How do you assess a bond? How do you monitor a bond? What are the things that you're looking at? So for instance, the separately managed account manager we use, some of the stuff that they're doing is they're looking in newspapers for city council meetings, for anything that could be causing tension with the taxing authority. And so process is really important here. You know, people focus on the cost of bond management, right? And they sometimes look and say, well, it'd be cheaper to do it through an ETF. Sure, it might. But what is the process and the due diligence to continually monitor the bonds to make sure there's not a default? And in certain parts of the bond market, certain pockets of it, like high yield, mortgage back, floating rate, it is incredibly complex. You truly need someone watching the shop, and that's what you're paying for. That type of due diligence and analytical work to protect you from downside risk. What I would suggest to anyone is if you have a chance, go on Morningstar, put your bond funds in, and take a look at all the different credit qualities that your bond funds have together. Because you might have high credit quality in a municipal mutual fund, but you might have slightly lower credit qualities in a high yield fund. And you want to make sure that you're diversified, that your bond managers are working together. I would also take a look when you're working through Morningstar at duration and yield to maturity to really, truly understand what's going on in your bond portfolio. So as I said before, bonds are incredibly complex. I sometimes work with people in high net worth and ultra high net worth where we manage their private investments and we manage their fixed income. And we let them do their equities on their own because they like to or they want to index, because those spaces, private investing and bonds, are really, really hard to manage and navigate the appropriate way.
You made a point there about paying for a manager. I think as interest rates were really low, paying for a bond manager seemed challenging. I'm not going to stay with the expenses because they're all different, but if you're paying 50 basis points, let's say, for a bond manager and you're yielding 2%, that's a big chunk, right? And people might feel like, I don't want to pay that expense. But to your point, I think it's worth it, especially, you know, in this environment. So as we get close to wrapping it up here, Barb, final thoughts from you.
I want to add in, first of all, Megan, great idea about using Morningstar. I want to inform the listeners that the tool she's talking about on Morningstar is called the X-ray. And it helps you look into not only bonds, but what's in your mutual funds and your ETFs and your overall portfolio. So just wanted to add that. And I'm kind of like a broken record because I believe educating yourself about investing, whether you're a DIY investor or you hire a manager or a little bit of both, is so important. So read a few articles on Investopedia about bonds. Learn a little bit about them and make a decision whether you need to give them a little more attention than you might have in the past, given that we are in a little bit of a changing economic environment. So if you want to learn more about me, you can visit my websites at Barbara Friedberg Personal Finance or Robo Advisor Pros, or follow me on YouTube. Bye.
Thanks for coming on, Barb. Megan, final thoughts from you.
You've heard all my thoughts. Feel free to find me at thewealthintersection.com or at Forbes at forbes.com/Megan Gorman. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on, Megan. Yeah, that's the show for this week. I would just advise all listeners just to, you know, always check your assumptions. You know, we all make assumptions about the market and about investing, and sometimes those assumptions change. You know, right now we're going through a paradigm shift, in my opinion, and we just released a video about that and thoughts about what that means for you and your money and for your family. So highly suggest you relook at your assumptions, understand why you're investing and what you're investing in. There are no good or bad investments. There are only good or bad prices. That's the show for this week. Thank you again for joining us at Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name is Kirk Chisholm, wealth manager at Innovative Advisory Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find more about me at innovativewealth.com. And of course, you can find me every week here on the show. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast and the podcast app of your choosing. You can also check out the show at moneytreepodcast.com. On our website, you'll have access to the show notes, resources, and the archive shows. Also, we're now on YouTube, so please check out our YouTube channel. When you're there, please subscribe and leave a comment. Lastly, please leave a show rating and comment in the podcast app of your choice. Have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.